here with them so that we won't have to think very long when it's time for us to recall some of these things. We began with a passage that says, "By what authority doest thou these things? And who gave thee this authority?" Where is it found? John. That's right. Jesus responded to their question with a question. What was it? All right, heaven or men, indicating that there are only two possible sources for authority. Where do I read about Cain and Abel, David, little David? Genesis 4, New Testament passage that compares Cain and Abel. Where is it found? Hebrews 11:4. Very good. Randy, passage that says, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord." Where is it?
Colossians 3:17.
Good. Lynn, passage that discusses King Uzziah. He was lifted up with pride and offered incense.
I want to say 1 Chronicles.
2 Chronicles. All right. Chapter?
No, I don't know.
Help her out, David.
26.
2 Chronicles 26, beginning at verse 16. That's right. Megan, I want to read about a passage that says that there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. There are two. Katie?
Proverbs 14:12.
And Proverbs? Emily? 16:25. Good. I like that just answer right up. That's good. There's a passage where Jesus said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" Carolyn?
Luke 6:46.
Good. Passages teaching that we're not under the Old Testament law. We're not under the Old Testament. Joey?
Hebrews 1.
Hebrews 1, yes. David?
Matthew 28:18.
All right. Christ claimed to have all authority in heaven and on earth. Sarah? Not under the old law. Passages. Help her out, Amy. Not under the old covenant. Chris?
All of Romans,
yes. In fact, three books in the New Testament address this subject. Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews, yes. Two particular passages tell us that the law was nailed to the cross. It's over, done, and through. Remember where? James? Yes, that's correct. The scene of the Transfiguration, where Jesus was with Moses and Elijah. And Peter spoke and said that, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us build three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Cloud overshadowed them. A voice said, "This is my beloved son, hear ye him." Dan, where is it? The Transfiguration. David? Excellent. Very good. All right. The Bible teaches us in at least one of three ways: direct statements, approved apostolic examples, and by a forced or a necessary inference. Give me an example and passage of a commandment, Megan, where the Bible teaches by command. Okay. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. That's a pretty direct command. Yeah, good. Emily, give me another one. Illustrate how the Bible teaches by command. Joey?
Acts 2:38.
Repent ye and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Christ. Daniel? Bible teaches by command. Give me an illustration. All right, that's true. Give me another example. David? All right, all of those. Yeah, that illustrates commands. One that we're under in particular, James?
Well, now you've qualified the question.
I have.
I raised my hand. St. Mark 16:15, go.
All right, and who was that instructed to?
That was to the apostles.
It was, but it still illustrates a command. One that we're looking at in particular has to do with the observance of the Lord's Supper. Very directly. This do in remembrance of me. All right? The Bible teaches us by approved apostolic examples. Now, that's important. What are we talking about? An approved apostolic example. Terry, what is that? It is. Bound by whom?
Bound by the Word of God.
Well, true, but illustrated in the life of the apostles, the things that they taught. Now we want to find a passage that teaches that the apostles' examples become binding.
1 Corinthians 11:1.
All right, Paul said what?
Be imitators of me as I am of Christ.
All right, be imitators of me as I also am of Christ. Lynn, give me another one. Excellent. What's it say?
Isn't it essentially as we've done, you also?
That's right. The things that you have seen and heard in me, these things do. David?
Acts 28:7. Upon the first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread.
All right, that becomes an illustration of something we learn by approved apostolic example. We read there of the saints in Troas. When they came together to observe the Lord's Supper was upon the first day of the week. David Dixon, I think I saw your hand a while ago.
Galatians 1:12.
All right.
About Paul getting it from Christ.
All right. All right. That becomes the source then of authority. It came from Christ. A necessary inference or a necessary conclusion. The Bible teaches us in that way. And what we're talking about is where certain data is given, although the specifics of the conclusion are not stated, but they are forced. You must draw that as a conclusion. The Bible teaches us in that way. Let me illustrate. In Matthew, the 3rd chapter, we find about verse 16, the text tells us that as Jesus came up out of the water, the Holy Spirit descended upon him in the form of a dove. Now, does the text explicitly tell us that Jesus went down into the water, Sarah? No, it does not. Doesn't mention it at all. But do you know that he went down into the water? How do you know that? Because it says he came out. You can't come up out of the water without having gone down into the water. We see also Jesus using that technique of teaching when he met with the Sadducees. The Sadducees presented a scenario they thought that he couldn't answer. There was a man who was married, and according to the law, if the man dies and he doesn't have any children, then his brother is to take his wife and raise children to his honor, as it were. And they described this scenario that they thought was impossible to explain, how that there were 7 brothers, and each one of them died, and so each one of them got the wife passed down to them. Now their question was, after all 7 of them had her, then in the resurrection, whose wife would she be? Now that's an interesting scenario, but Jesus told them that in the resurrection, you're neither married nor given in marriage, after rebuking them, saying you don't know the Scriptures nor the power of God. But he said in the resurrection, they're not married or given in marriage. Now pertaining to the subject of the resurrection, this becomes important because Jesus has not only answered their question, but he's answering their position. They denied the existence of the resurrection. Now Jesus said, have you not read that God said, what did God say? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now think with me. If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had been dead for centuries, but yet Jesus is quoting the text where God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What conclusion must you draw? Did Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob just cease from existence when they died? Or were they awaiting the resurrection? Now that's an inevitable conclusion. You can't avoid that conclusion based on the data that Jesus gave. And those folks understood his teaching. We know that because they wanted to kill him. They understood what he said. Now once authority has been established for a particular practice, then we must determine whether there are any choices in the fulfilling of the thing that's authorized or not. And this is where we are on this particular chart. We've been talking for the past couple of weeks about generic authority and specific authority. And we've illustrated this from a number of standpoints. We talked about the instructions given to Noah to build an ark. We noted that generic authority includes aids in carrying out the command. Now, one of the qualifying factors of these aids that help to carry out the command is that they don't alter or change the commandment. You can't alter or change the commandment. We notice that Noah was instructed to build an ark, but we see that the specific dimensions of the ark were given to Noah. Now, would that require that Noah has some kind of measuring device to build the ark according to those specified dimensions? Would it? Why, certainly so. Did God say anything about using a ruler? No, it's not in the text at all. But we know that that's included in the command to build an ark, because you can't build one 30 cubits long without having something to measure 30 cubits. Now, if you're building it to the specified cubits, then you're also going to have something more than a measuring device. You ever cut something to size? Do you need a tool to cut it? Or can you just imagine it to be that long and therefore it shrinks up to that long? Well, now Noah wasn't told about saws and hammers and specific tools, but were these tools included in the generic command to build the ark? Well, sure they were. You can't build an ark without having the tools necessary. But we saw that God told Noah to build the ark out of gopher wood. Now, could Noah reason and say, well, I think I'll build the frame out of hickory because hickory's a good pliable wood, but the boxing on the outside, I'll make that out of gopher wood. Could he then claim hickory as an aid to the building of the ark? Could he? Why not, Megan? That's right. And if he reasoned and said, well, hickory's a good pliable wood, I'll use it for the framework. He's added, he's changed, he's altered what God says. Now, that's not hard, is it? But it's a principle that's often overlooked in Bible study. We also notice that regarding ourselves, the Lord has instructed us to observe the Lord's Supper. We've read about that and studied it extensively. From 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the Apostle Paul said that the things he received of the Lord, that's what he's delivering to them. And he quoted the instruction of the Lord regarding the observance of the Lord's Supper. This do. You do this. Now, did he tell us what day to do it? By the approved apostolic example. Acts chapter 20, verse 7. Tells us that those early disciples in Troas came together upon the first day of the week to break bread. What does that say about Monday or Thursday or Wednesday or any other day of the week? Can we assume that those days are just as good as, or would somehow aid or expedite the carrying out of the command? What's authorized? The first day of the week. Is that generic or specific? Regarding days, that's specific, isn't it? Now, during the first day of the week, what hour may we come together to observe the Lord's Supper? Is that generic or specific? That's generic. Now, here's something sometimes that we miss. Here we see that the specific time of day, the Lord did not specify that. Let me go on just one step further on that. Did the Lord tell us regarding acts of worship upon the first day of the week, which ones are the most important to us? Did he tell us that? No, he didn't say that. But we're to worship. You see, when we begin to put an unequal emphasis upon any commandment of the Lord, now we've stepped over the line, we don't understand the difference between generic and specific. Because something is specified doesn't make it more important than other things. The first day of the week, in this respect, is not more important, but it's the day that's authorized. Other days are not. Now, do we see that? Any question at all about that? We've talked about these things, and we've noted that in carrying out the command to observe the Lord's Supper, why you can't partake of the fruit of the vine without having some kind of container to put it in, can you? It'd sure be tough. Maybe we might go out and get the grapes and hold them up and squeeze them, you see. But there is a container of some sort that's involved in carrying out this command. We might also notice that there is a place that is authorized. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the Apostle Paul said, beginning about verse 19, when you come together, it's not for the better, it's for the worse. For when you come together, I hear that there are divisions among you. Now, we find that expression, when you come together in the church. Now, Paul is not using the word church there to talk about a physical structure. That's important that we see that. Every time the word church is used in the Bible, it's used to talk about people. It's used in different contexts to talk about different people, but it's always used to identify a called out body of people. It's not ever used in the Bible to talk about a building. But you know, strangely enough, folks talk about, well, I'm going to go down to the church. No, you might go to the church building, but the building is not the church. The church is people. Okay? Now, when we understand that, and we see that these folks in 1 Corinthians 11 were instructed to come together in the church to partake of the Lord's Supper, he's telling them that you come together. Can you come together without a place? I'd like to see you try that. Get a bunch of folks together without a place. How are you going to do it? Place, then, is authorized. It is a forced conclusion that in order for brethren to come together, there must be a place. Now, the kind of place is generic. You see, you might have a rented building. You might have a borrowed building. You might meet out under a tree somewhere. That, in respect, is generic. But you can't meet without a place. That's authorized. Now, once you find that a place is authorized by necessary inference, Hebrews 10, verse 25 tells us to not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Well, if we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, then what is it that is authorized? We are to assemble ourselves together. Now, if we are to assemble ourselves together, then a place is necessarily inferred. You can't have an assembly without a place. Now, regarding generics, whether you have lights, electric lights, or you have candles to light the walls where you can see and not fall over yourselves, or whether you have pews to sit in, or whether you just stand up like the Israelites did when they heard the law read from early morning to midday. You see, that allows for some choices. But coming together to observe the Lord's Supper, we see that the day becomes specific regarding what we are to partake, unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. That is specific. That's why we don't have hamburgers and Coca-Cola on the Lord's table. You'll also notice that the instruction is, this do in remembrance of me. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, they had come together, but Paul said it's not to observe the Lord's Supper, for in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper. Now, do you see that distinction? It's not the Lord's Supper. Now it's your own supper. Well, what were they doing? They'd made a common meal out of it. Now, could they say, well, you know, we're all together and we all like each other and we're all hungry, so we'll just have a common meal together and claim that that is an aid to help us carry out the command to observe the Lord's Supper? No, no. Jesus said when you do that, it's not the Lord's Supper. It's your own supper now. And he said, what? Have you not houses to eat and drink in? Now, he said, you can do that on your own. But when you come together in the church, that's not the function of the church. Do we not see that making a feast, coming together for a common meal, is now changed the kind, the class of the coming together? We're not coming together now to partake of the Lord's Supper. We're coming together to each take his own supper. Now, that's a different purpose. Do we see that distinction? That is a different purpose. We've changed the class or kind of command now, so this is not an aid to doing this. It becomes an addition because the purpose of our coming together is specified. Now, does that make sense to anybody? Well, let's just go on just a little bit. Regarding the subject of baptism. Baptism includes some generics. For example, or let me illustrate. I have to be careful because I want to categorize these things just right. Regarding baptism, may someone be baptized in a baptistry? May someone be baptized in a, say, a swimming pool? How about a river or a creek or a pond? Well, sure. But when you use a baptistry, a swimming pool, a river or a creek or a pond, have you changed the command at all? Are you doing anything more or less than baptism? No. Now, if we claim that we want to baptize somebody, but you see, we don't want to use enough water to immerse them, which, by the way, the word baptize means. And just on a side note, I learned this not too long ago. I want to make you aware of it. You know the Greek word in this text, to baptize, the text being Acts 2, 38, Mark 16, 16, a number of places where the word appears, to baptize. We may have noted before that, and often in those texts where the word baptize occurs, the word is transliterated, not translated. And that's some terminology that I became acquainted with some time ago. But to translate a word is to take the Greek word and give the English equivalent of the word. But to transliterate a word is to take the Greek word and simply assign English letters to the Greek letters. So you basically bring over the Greek word with English letters. That's not translating. That's transliterating. Now to translate, remember, is to take the Greek word and to assign it an English equivalent. Now, to see an illustration of that, if you'll turn in your Bibles to Luke the 16th chapter, Joey, I'm going to pick on you. We read about the rich man and Lazarus, beginning about verse 19. Luke the 16th chapter, verse 19. Now you remember that the rich man died, and Lazarus also died, and he was carried up by the angels into Abraham's bosom. You remember that? And you remember the rich man lifted up his eyes and he was in torment. And he looked over there and he saw Abraham and he saw Lazarus. And he called upon Abraham. He said, Father Abraham, send Lazarus that he may dip his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame. Guess what Greek word is used there for the word dip? Baptizo. It's translated there. But it's transliterated in other passages. Now, why do you suppose that's so?
To establish a doctrine.
That's right. Because some of the translators were too careful during the 1611, in particular, translation of the King James Version, because infusion or pouring water or sprinkling water had already become very popular and was accepted in most religious circles. And interestingly enough, when the King James translation was translated in 1611, some of those fellows were too careful to weigh their scholarship against existing practice. So they transliterated the word. But to translate it is exactly what they did in Luke 16. Did you see that, Joey? Dip his finger in water. Now, what do you suppose the rich man wanted Lazarus to do with his finger? Sprinkle some water on it? What did he want the rich man to do with his finger, or the Lazarus to do with his finger? He wanted him to put it under, didn't he? Put it under the water and come over here and cool my tongue. Now, that's all the point we wanted to make on that. We're not here to talk about the rich man Lazarus, but the word is translated correctly in that text. It is to dip, and that's what the word baptize literally means. To dip, Joey. True. Yeah. Wouldn't be hard to see it. No. Yeah. Well, that's right. Right. I'm not falling out with the word baptize, except to understand what the original word means. The word does not mean to pour. It does not mean to sprinkle. It means to dip.
Didn't all the other translators cop out too?
Yeah. No, that's true. Well, probably. There might be some consequences imposed. Yeah, but this is kind of a side note. I want us to see that regarding authority, once authority has been established by direct statement or command or precept, approved apostolic example, or by necessary inference, now we raise the question, are there any things that might aid in carrying out the command? We see that there are. We see that we are commanded to sing and make melody in our hearts unto the Lord. What's the command? The command is generic regarding making melody, because we see that there are some aids that carry out that command. What are they? Well, we might use a songbook. It'd be very difficult for us to sing together and make melody tonight if we didn't have lights where we could see. Now, does that mean that a songbook is the only way we can do that? Well, no, we could put it on the projector and sing off the screen. We could do that, you see. We could sing from memory. We could pass out sheet music and let everybody look at a page and sing the songs. But when you do all of those things, have you done anything more or less than make melody? Have you? Have you changed the command or altered it in any way? You see, these then are aids, but let's look at some additions. Let's look at the text. Ephesians 5, verse 19. James, I want you to read that for me. And Randy, if you would please, Colossians 3, verse 16.
Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord.
Singing and making melody in your heart unto the Lord. Randy, go ahead. These passages authorize the kind of music, don't they? What kind of music do we see authorized as acceptable in worship, Lynn? Vocal music. Can you tell me another kind of music, Randy?
Non-vocal.
Yeah, non-vocal. For those of you who weren't here for that discussion, we were talking about vocal and instrumental, and somebody said, well, what about computer-generated sounds that sound like vocal? And I said, well, vocal and non-vocal, that'll work. But a computer is an instrument. But what we want to notice here is the kind of music is specified. Now, when you talk about vocal or non-vocal or instrumental, I don't know of any other kinds, do you? But what we do learn is God specified the kind. Now, somebody says, well, does that mean then that we should play a piano? Or have an organ, or have a 52-piece band. Well, now let's ask ourselves the question. Did God specify the kind? Did He specify that? Well, yes. Well, if I introduce another kind, even in accompaniment to singing, has it then become an aid, or has it become an addition? That's right.
Okay, and that "and" right there shows that you have an addition.
You've added another kind of music. That's right. Now, if we have the guitar in our lap, have I altered or changed the command at all? I have, haven't I? If I sing with the use of a songbook or lights, have I altered or changed the command? Am I doing anything more than singing? But when I take a guitar or a 52-piece band, yes, I'm singing, but I'm doing something more than singing. There's the addition. Randy?
This is kind of an aside because it's not really a scripturally based argument, but it makes sense. God requires us to worship using the only instrument that He made.
True.
All the other instruments are man-made.
True, true. Now, we can spend a lot of time talking about instrumental music. And maybe that would be appropriate for us to do, but what I want us to notice is everybody can sing who has the ability of use of vocal cords and so forth. We can do that. He didn't say sing pretty. He said sing. Now we can all strive to do that, can't we? But if the command to sing also means to employ an instrument, Would it not also mean that in addition to singing, which all are commanded to do, then all must also play an instrument? And I think sometimes we miss that, but more unique to make an argument regarding singing in the passages that were read in your hearing, we learn that we are to teach and to admonish one another. We are to teach and to admonish one another. What then becomes so unique about singing as opposed to a mechanical instrument? Has words. Words teach and admonish. Now I know Randy plays the drums. He doesn't do it in worship. But suppose that Randy gets his drums out and he wants to teach me something about spiritual life. And so he's just banging around and he hits the cymbal and he hits the bass and he hits the... And here he's going. And I might say, boy, that boy's talented. He can really play those drums. What have I learned about going to heaven? Not one thing. But when he sings, we teach, we admonish. The unique thing about singing is the use of words. And words are used to praise God, we find in these texts. Words are used to teach and to admonish each other. Now, that's probably enough on that point, but it helps us to see that when God specified singing, it didn't allow for the use of another kind of music. That changes the command. Let's notice one other illustration. We see that elders were to be appointed in every church, Acts chapter 14, verse 23. Here we see that the appointment of elders, that's the divine pattern. But yet we see that that may also involve certain aides. For example, every once in a while, Terry and I get together to talk about some things. Well, is that an aid in carrying out the responsibilities of elders? We may set a time when we're going to get together and talk about some things. Some very specific things. And so we get together and we talk about those things. Well, as we do that, that aids or expedites in the carrying out of the command to oversee. But when we set a time and we get together and we talk about some of these things, have we done anything more or less than the responsibilities we have as elders? Well, no. But now let's suppose that we get together as an eldership and we begin to decide things for other congregations. We make decisions and get together and talk about things that we're going to impose on other congregations. Maybe the church somewhere else doesn't have elders. And so we say, well, we're elders. We're elders in Lancaster, so what we'll do is impose our decision on this congregation over here. Now, question, have we engaged in an addition, or now are we exercising simply an aid? We find that we have added to what God said. Because God said that elders are to feed the flock of God which is among you. What authority would Terry and I have to exercise any role in the workings of another congregation? Now the lesson to be learned there, we'll notice in a little bit, has to do with the formulation of councils, conventions, sponsoring churches. Do we not see that these are not aids in the carrying out of the command of overseers? But these then become another kind of organization. God's organization is elders over local churches, each church. But what we find here is a complex organizational structure where you have overseeing bodies over several congregations. The Bible doesn't teach that. We can't claim then that as an aid because now we have developed another kind of organizational structure. Joey and then Richard.
At that point, you've changed the hierarchy.
Yes.
You've changed the pattern.
Yes. Yes. We've changed not only the hierarchy, the pattern, we've changed the work. So we've got another kind of work, another kind of organization, etc., etc., etc. So it's not an aid, it's an addition. Now, I left this chart blank because I want you to think about some things. You have these charts. You illustrate these things. Generics include aids in carrying out the thing authorized by direct statement, approved example, or necessary inference. When God gives specific authority, that excludes other things, and they become an addition if we try to employ them. Now, does that make sense to us? Now, of course, the premise that we've started with is the necessity of adhering to divine authority. Now, I mentioned to you last time that I wanted to get to the questions on lesson number 5. You have that, right? The questions on lesson number 5. That was Wednesday night. I guess they're all given out. No, here's some. If you don't have the questions, here is an abridged copy of the lesson that includes some of the charts and the questions.
Is that an A-B portion?
Yes. The questions on A-B. And by the way, if you don't have 5C, I've got that right here. Be sure you pick one up because we're going to be discussing that, it looks like, next week. Okay? I really want to get to that and talk about the silence of the Scriptures. But for now, we've got to nail this down. Generic and specific. We've got to understand the difference. All right? Let's look now at the section, Reading the Text. Now, as I've mentioned to you, these quotations are from the King James translation. That'll help you because sometimes you might find, if you're reading from another translation, the blank don't exactly fit. These quotations are from the King James translation. What I've asked you to do is fill in the blank in the quotation and tell me where the passage is found. First of all, Richard, number one. Something to be said for hard copy. Linda, you have it? All right, where's it found? All right, good. Number two, Richard, you got it there yet? All right, I'll move right on. Randy. Uh-oh, Carolyn. Oh, you know that one, Randy. Yeah. Yes, Amy.
That's the second one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him his door as thou hast heard in him. 1 Corinthians 15:1-2.
Very good. Very good. Number three, Donna. Very good. Number four, James.
And Jesus, when he was baptized, went up straightway out of the water. Matthew 3:16.
Excellent. Number five, John. Pardon me? What did he say? I didn't hear it. Megan. All right. Very good. Number six, little David. You know that. Look at it. You know that. All right, good. Now, where's it found? Good. See, I told you knew that. Very good. Carolyn, number seven. Right, where is it found? Yes, 26, yes. Number 8, Richard, you there yet? Terry, go ahead. I'll take that as a no. All right, good. Number 9, David.
I could do that.
David.
Mentioned in the ark of the covenant, the ark of the shelf, put in with him, or pitch it with him, about, I think, pitch or something.
With pitch, that's right. Yeah, that's found where? All right, it's chapter 6, verse, David, 14. Thank you. Number 10, Dan. Number 10.
Speaking to them in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and making melody in my heart.
To the Lord. Yeah, yeah. Speaking to yourselves. And where is that found? Anybody? Good boy, we nailed that. All right, questions. Number one, Daniel, what are three ways of establishing Bible authority? Yes. Excellent. Number two, what does Luke 13:3 authorize us to teach? What does Luke 13:3 authorize us to teach? Joey. Help me out, Megan. All right, that's right. Now, by what one of the three methods of understanding or communicating or teaching do we find that passage to illustrate? How's that? I didn't say that very well, did I? Good. Now, she understood me, didn't she? Very good. All right. Number three, give some examples of something learned by direct statement. Direct statement. Richard?
Going into all the world to preach the gospel.
You found it, huh? There it is. All right, good. Give me another illustration, Terry.
Well,
things we learn. All right.
There are three items there.
All right. And go ahead and name
them.
All right.
Belief, repentance, and baptism.
Exactly. David. All right. Does the Bible authorize number four by approved example? Lynn?
Yes.
Yes. Now we want to illustrate it.
Well, the Lord's Supper was on the first day of the week.
That's right. That is an example of when they came together to observe that. Number five, what is a necessary inference? Randy? Yes. Now, letter A says, tell the difference between an inference and a necessary inference. Joey?
A necessary inference would be a conclusion that's forced. In other words, there's no other options. There's nothing else you can conclude.
All right.
Inference is not necessary, but can be inferred.
All right. There may be multiple inferences, but when it comes to a necessary inference, only one. It's a forced conclusion, a single forced conclusion. Emily, show the how the Lord's Supper illustrates the three ways of establishing authority. Good.
And in Acts 27, there is approved apostolic example for the first day of the week.
Very good.
And I'm not sure about necessary.
All right. The frequency of observance is necessarily inferred in that each week has a first day. It's necessarily inferred. Everybody see that? We often compare that to the Old Testament text in Exodus 20 of remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, which Sabbath were they to remember? Everyone. Everyone. As often as there was a Sabbath, they were to keep it holy. Very good, Emily. Number 7. Read 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, and chapter 10, verse 23. We want to read those because we haven't introduced those yet. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12. Randy, you have it for me, please? All right. And James, 10:23, please.
1 Corinthians 6:12. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything.
All right, James.
All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify.
All right. Now you used what translation, Randy? The New American Standard, and it said that all things are lawful, but not all things are what?
Profitable.
And yours was, not all things are
helpful.
When you think of something that's profitable, something that's helpful, we're talking about aids, aren't we? Aids expedite the carrying out of the command. The King James translators and the American Standard translators use the word expedient. Not expedient. It may be lawful, but it's not expedient. Now, we've got a whole lesson on expediency, so we're going to hold that thought just a little bit, but let's ask the question. Is it wrong to appeal to expediency as a means of establishing authority? Now, be careful in your answer. Joey, you're nodding yes, that's wrong. Why?
I would say yes, that's wrong.
All right, why?
Because if there's a commandment that says to go and teach, and if I say, okay, an expediency is taking using a camel, then if I try to establish a law and say, therefore, you must take a camel, I have used an expediency to try to establish law.
All right.
And I can't do that.
All right, very good argument. Where do you begin? In establishing authority, you don't start over here with expediencies. You start with what's lawful. Now, how do you establish what's lawful? That's right. Command, necessary inference, and approved apostolic example. That's how you establish what's lawful. Well, that works too. Yeah? Yeah? All right, number 8. Define generic and specific authority. Generic allows for aids or choices. Specific excludes. Now just remember the terminology. Generic includes, specific excludes. That's enough to know on that. You've got it. All right, number 9. What material did God authorize Noah to use in the building of the ark? Emily? Gopher wood. Was God specific as to the kind of wood? Sarah? Yes. Would God have said, or what would God have said, if any wood would do? Amy?
He would have said, "Any wood you want."
He would have said, "Build it out of wood."
He didn't say that, though.
But he didn't say that. He specified the kind of wood. So not just any wood would do, would it? You didn't think I could do that, did you? Number 10, rather. Read Exodus 12, verse 5. Lynn? Exodus 12, verse 5.
Okay, Exodus 12, verse 5. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats.
All right, a lamb. Well, is that specific? And we talked about the lamb and the goat, and we talked about the term that's used there. But did God specify the animal? Now, if He was going to say something that would allow them choice regarding the kind of animal, what would He have said?
Just pick an animal.
Pick an animal. Offer an animal. But He didn't say that. That would have been generic. But He was specific in telling them the kind of animal. You're telling me I'm out of time, aren't you? I thought that. Well, we'll start with number 11 next time. No, I didn't. All right, Joey, was it necessary for God to name all the animals that were excluded?
No, because He specified what was to be
used. All right, thank you.
And Mickey, that's a terribly important point, because this plays right into the thing we've all heard 1,000 times when they say, where did the Bible doesn't say you can't do that?
Got a whole lesson on that. That's our next lesson, the silence of the Scriptures.